Because we have done the heavy lifting, dear students. It's time for some silliness. Anybody Monty Python fan? Anybody? I'm a big Monty Python fan, and I love silliness. So we'll take a look. And there's a little bit of silliness in this chapter, but there's a whole lot more silliness in the next chapter. But there's actually some nuggets of information that we want to pull from these guys. So let's burn through this. And who knows, we might get to chapter, I don't think we're going to chapter 8 today. Depends. It's up to you, because you can ask as many questions as you want, because remember, I could talk about this a whole lot longer than most, any reasonable person would ever want to listen. Okay. Anybody want to sell anything or buy anything? Anybody looking for? I got a desk for sale. My wife is always changing things. It's small. We just do small things. This desk is too big. Let's get something smaller. I already have one smaller. Okay, you can use mine. I don't want to use my desk that much. So she's going to take my desk. We're selling a pretty large desk. Is anyone interested? If not, I just take it down to TJ. To Calle Martinez. Where they're always selling stuff. And I just drop it off and people take it and sell it. God bless them. Okay. Stock price behavior and market efficiency. Did everybody get one? Everybody get one? Okay, well, that's good. There's lots of extra students. No, that's why we lost so many students. I'm not happy about that. If you guys can figure out how to not lose somebody. I'm not alone. I'm not saying it's just me. It's just, we all lose a lot of students, and you wonder why that is. Gavin here? Okay, who else? Jennifer. Efren, no. Neo, no. Antonio, yes. Joshua, no. Gavin, Antonio. Do I have yours? Okay, Antonio. Did I say Neo? Yeah, Neo's there. Eric, no. Jonathan, no. Okay, you got something for me? Excellent. All right, so now, they call it chapter price behavior and market efficiency. I would, if I were naming it, which I'm not, in this chapter, can you beat the market, right? And so it's become the boogeyman, the S&P 500 index. Can you beat the S&P 500 index? Well, there were lots of research in the late 1960s and into the early 1970s that tried to quantify this idea of who can beat the market. But it's nothing new, right? It's nothing new. Sir Isaac Newton, you ever hear of him? Remember gravity? Yeah, supposedly the apple hit him on the head. Newtonian physics. I can calculate the movement of the stars, but not the madness of men. And he understood better than many people at the time, because he was one of the people who got rooked by one of the financial picadillos, the South Seas Project, which was a big, you know, everybody, they're all going to get rich, quick, run down, they're giving away free money. And the whole thing imploded. Well, he was one of them that got burnt. So he was not happy about this. He liked his physics better than he liked people's emotions. And I don't blame him, because physics is cut and dried, and people are not rational. So, in the 1960s and late 1960s and into the 1970s, the academics started coming up with these hypotheses. The theory, the random walk hypothesis. In fact, one of the books I told you about, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, was written by one of the professors who was involved in this endeavor. And he excoriates the fundamental analysis that we've been doing in chapters 5, 6, and 17. And he excoriates the technical analysis that we'll do next Tuesday in chapter 8. And he excoriates his own people, the efficient market theorists. The random walk theory says that stock price movements are unpredictable. And you know what? They're absolutely right. In the short term. In the short term, you remember the graphic I showed you, the month-to-month? Was just, you couldn't pick out any particular pattern, any particular pattern. But then when you look at it over the long term, yeah, in the long term, as the global economy expands and more people come out of poverty and not working for a dollar a day, you know, they have clean, they're going to have clean water, they're going to have access to good food and health care and the like. No, failure is not an option, in my humble opinion. So in the long term, unless the world ends, in which case all bets are off, no, stock price movements are not random. I've heard, read one person explain it like this. It's like a yo-yo. But you're walking up the stairs while you're doing it. While the thing is bouncing around, you're still growing the economy. And they came up with what's called the efficient market theory. This is a market in which securities reflect all possible information quickly and accurately. If there are large numbers of knowledgeable buyers and sellers, investors who react quickly to new information, securities prices will adjust quickly and accurately. And the New York Stock Exchange, the NASDAQ, these are efficient markets because there are millions of people buying and selling at any one time. If you have a very small market where there's not as many buyers and sellers, then efficiencies can creep into the system. But, you know, we don't deal with those in this class. We deal with the large cap companies in the most part. A Random Walk Down Wall Street. I told you, go read that book. It's one of the two really good books you should read, first books. Now, they came up with these, they gave them names that if you know anything about physics, you'll see that they're basically borrowing from the world of physics. They have the weak efficiency hypothesis. Past data on stock prices are of no use in predicting future prices. However, what we're going to see in Chapter 8 is that there are trends. You know, stock prices do tend to demonstrate momentum. They tend to rise more often than they fall. They tend to move far higher than is usually justified, a mania, a bubble, and they fall far lower than is warranted, a crash. And Sir John Maynard Keynes, who was one of the chief economists that helped the world get out of the Great Depression, said it this way: look, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. A group of investors, very savvy investors, are saying, these prices are so high, they're so high. And he agreed with them. He said, look, you're right. You know, the market is overvalued, in my humble opinion. But the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent. What they were doing is they were shorting stocks. They were trying to make the stocks go down and make money that way. And we'll discuss that at the end of the semester because it's dangerous. Don't do it. And they were complaining, this is irrational. This is market's irrational. It's too overpriced. Well, the market can stay irrational longer than you can stay solvent, which means if you bet against market prices going up, and they do, you lose fast. You lose a lot of money quickly. And so that's why they were going insolvent. So if this theory is true, then technical analysis, which we will cover in the next chapter, is basically useless. You can't just look at the past price behavior and come up with the future price. But there are people who believe that, and we'll see them next week. The semi-strong efficiency hypothesis. Abnormally large profits cannot be consistently earned using publicly available information. In other words, there's nothing you can do. Forget about it. No amount of analysis that you do, everything we did in chapters 5, 6, and 17, forget it. It's not going to help you. To determine the future price of a stock will help you beat the market. The problem with this theory is that there are many investors who have beaten the market over significantly statistically significant periods of time. So what does the theory say about these? You see, you have a theory and it doesn't pertain or doesn't follow the reality. You got to come up with a reason. So they say, oh, they're just lucky. These people were just lucky. And the answer to that is the famed, if you look it up, you'll see that it's attributed to many different golfers. But supposedly this one golfer did really, really well, beat all the other people, and a reporter said to him, you know, you were really lucky today. And he said, you're absolutely right. The more I practice, the luckier I get. Really? How that works. In other words, can you hit a fastball at 95 miles an hour? I'm not even going to get near the damn thing. Right? But that doesn't mean there are people who can't. Can you dunk a basketball? Neither can I. But there are people who can do that. Can you sing a four-hour opera? It sounds, oh, it's easy, right? You know, it's not. But trust me. Because I have taken music, I have singing lessons a long time ago. But yeah, no, but there are people who can do that, and they get paid very well. And so if this theory is true, which I don't believe it is, then everything we did in chapters 5, 6, and 17 is useless. Don't even bother. They just say don't bother. But that's, we're going to see some people who have done it over time. And my belief is if you want to do well, go look at the people who have done well. Do you have chapter 17, 7? Okay. Chapter 17. No, here's chapter 7. That's the one we're doing right now. And where's chapter 17? Okay, next one. The strong. This is obviously ridiculous. I mean, how can they say this? No information, public or private, allow investors to earn abnormally large profits consistently. It's wrong. I mean, one insider information trade can make you instantly rich. If you knew that a company's drug was going to be denied by the FDA overnight, right, you can make a ton of money. You can make a ton of money. But you could also go to jail. Right? And so, obviously, you know, this is wrong. If you, and here's the name for insider, this is the real name. I'm going to ask you on the exam because you're supposed to know it. But we call it insider information. But the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, calls it material non-public information. And if you're kind of interested in the legal aspects of this, is just look it up. You'll see countless examples of people who were tried, you know, were accused of insider information and making deals off of that, and then sometimes they went to jail. Martha Stewart, she didn't actually go to jail for that. She went to jail for lying about it. And I'm sure that her publicist said, "Go to jail. You'll do, I don't know, you'll do a few months, and you'll be on the news, and then you'll show the inmate. You'll teach them. They'll show you teaching the inmates how to make a turkey or something like that." And because they had it dead, I mean, they had it dead to sight. You know, they had the stockbroker who said that, yeah, she said sell. We knew it was going to go. And then there are other examples where at a very exclusive golf resort, a muckety-muck in the sports world, I'm not sure, I don't remember the name of the guy, but somebody in the sports world who was fairly wealthy, overheard a CEO or somebody else at talking about problems at the company or whatever, and he acted on that. Which, you know, that's you think, wait a minute, that's insider information. But it was totally gotten, not from his own, he didn't ask the guy, the guy didn't tell him in confidence. And so he got off. He was able to get away with that. So, so if you have material non-public information, you can make a fortune overnight, but also go to jail. So, the random walk and efficient market theorists are often also major proponents of index funds. Why? They say, look, we don't believe people can beat the market, so just buy the market. And there is some truth to this. Not all, but many mutual fund managers, more than 50%, do not beat the market, especially during bull markets. From 1963 to 1998, the S&P 500 index outperformed general mutual fund index 22 out of 36 times. So more than half. They reason you're better off accepting close to the market's return. You're not going to get the market's return because remember there's some friction in there. There's some fee, a little bit, hopefully, unless you got it snuck into your 401k. They got a high fee index fund. You're better off just sticking with low-cost index funds since their theory tells them that no one can consistently beat the market. And the gentleman who wrote Burton Malkiel's book, the book, Random Walk on Wall Street, was one of the advisors to Vanguard when they started. They weren't the only ones doing it. There were other companies doing it, but they were the ones that started the first retail index fund, the Index 500. Why can't many pros beat the averages? Well, we saw that some mutual funds have high annual operating expenses, right? So you're right up there. You got one hand tied behind your back. The S&P 500 doesn't have any fees because it's not being traded by anybody. It's just a list of companies. Many mutual fund managers have a short time horizon because they know, depending on the company, that they only have 18 months, 24 months, 18 months to a year, to 2 years, to produce, or they're out of there. So they tend to, if they're smart, which they are, these people got to be where they are not because they're stupid, they tend to roll the dice. They tend to be more aggressive. And if they win, great. You know, they get showered with love and attention and a hell of a lot of money, and they get to keep their jobs. And if they lose, oh well. So this is the way it used to be at many companies, Fidelity, and they blew up in their face. And other companies like T. Rowe Price and American said, no, we're more long-term oriented. So now more and more companies, mutual funds, are giving their mutual fund managers 4, 8, 10 years. Tough to get a job. But the premises and casual operations of the efficient market theory show them to be patently absurd. I mean, many, many mutual fund managers have beaten the market over statistically long periods of time. And so, you know, the more I practice, the better I get. Plus, if markets are efficient and rational, how do you explain manias? How do you explain, is it too late to get in? Occasionally, investors get a cut off of what are called manias, also called bubbles. It's going to be on the exam, so mania or bubble, either one. The internet bubble of the 1990s was the latest stock market mania. Some people say we're in a bubble now. I'd say no, a stock market bubble. I'd say there are some companies that are wildly overpriced, and whether you agree that Netflix is worth 134 PE is a matter that we'll find out whether that person, you are right, in 3 or 4 years, right? We'll see. But there was no doubt that at the time, you know, stocks were just wildly overpriced. There was the Nifty 50 of the early 1970s. These were companies, no matter what, don't worry about the price. There was only a few dozen of these companies. You ever hear of Xerox? It's still around, but it's nothing like it used to be. CalComp or Tektronix, Metro Media, Avon was one of them. And these were companies that, you know, and they crashed and burned. The mania of the 1920s. Have you ever heard of Radio Corporation of America? You have?
Yeah.
No, you're thinking of somebody else. That's RCA, right. RCA, right, yeah. That's what Radio Corporation of America was called, and they called it RCA. And in 1929, it sold for $290. 4 years later, it sold for $2 and never recovered. And in fact, that company is gone. The name lives on, but that company is gone. In the 1840s, there were 400 railroad firms. That was the new technology. How many railroad firms are there? Less than a handful, yeah. And the granddaddy of all manias, although now there's some controversy about whether it's true or not, was discussed in a book called The Extraordinary Popular Delusions and the Madness of Crowds. You must read this book. It won't explain why we humans are the way we are, but it goes through the witch trials and the crusades and the two big picadillos, Louisiana, whatever it was, and the South Seas Project, that were huge bubbles at the time. And then another book called The Botany of Desire actually does a better job of the granddaddy of all manias, the Dutch tulip bulb craze. In the early 1600s, tulip bulbs were imported, I think, from Turkey to the Netherlands, where now we think of tulips, we think of the Netherlands, we think of Holland, right? But they came from someplace else, but that's where they are now. And they were the mania. They started trading these things like stocks. Tulip bulbs, right. You know, what happens when you put a tulip bulb in the ground?
It grows.
It grows and?
It blooms.
It blooms and?
And then it dies.
Well, in the meantime, what do we do when we grow up? We smell it. You smell it. No, we make more babies, right? So eventually, they make more and more tulip bulbs until finally the market, you know, One poor sailor who didn't know what was going on, he came to town and he saw one sitting there. He thought it was an onion because they're relatives of onions. And he ate it. Each time. Oh, by the way, the crash of 2008 and 2009 was not caused by the stock market, folks. It was caused by the housing market and the bonds that were tied to the mortgages that were tied to the houses that were higher loans. And each time you hear people say, oh, it's different. This time it's a new era. The old ways of valuing stock are gone. And each time they're wrong. So when you hear people say, it's different this time. Well, really, it is different every day. Right? Every day is different. But there are echoes of the past, and that's what we see. And why do manias occur over and over again? Why haven't investors learned their lesson? Any ideas? Why?
Greed.
Greed, right? And this, I like this guy, Leonard Kaplan, who is the president of commodities at this, I just love this. Market manias will happen over and over again because the public is infinitely stupid. Yeah, people are stupid. I mean, we got Trump, right? Okay.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, right. Benjamin Graham says, look, the speculative public is incorrigible. This is from the Intelligent Investor. It will buy anything at any price if there seems to be some action in it. It will fall for any company. This is in the early 70s. 1972 is the last time he updated the book. It will fall for any company identified with franchising, computers, electronics, science, technology, or what have you. When the particular fashion is raging, the abuses are so largely the result of the public's own heedlessness and greed. Of course, the technology has changed, right? Today it would be social networking, wearables, marijuana, China. So you put the name there, and people go, "Oh, okay, I gotta buy marijuana stocks. It's illegal in the United States." So no, it's legal in California. Okay, and so how do manias end? Why don't you say with a crash? How do manias end? With, you know, it's like a Greek tragedy. You know at the end there's going to be all dead bodies on the ground. Everybody's going to die. You just don't know when. You don't know how long it's going to happen. The bigger the party, I like this term, the bigger the party you have this, the bigger the hangover. They are not fun, but the odds are you will be living at least through one, probably more than one, during your investing career. Now, this was a guy in 1999 who people thought he was out of his mind. Right? He had been in the industry almost 50 years. He retired a couple years later. With this many, in fact, his there's an obituary. He died in 2008 on the website about him because he's sharp. He really was sharp. With this many strong years, I have the concern that there are a vast majority of companies that are significantly overvalued on a long-term basis. Now, I said this in August of 1999, when people were just partying like crazy. Oh, boy, internet, blue skies, Y2K, productivity gains, on into the future, and then, boom. Oh, as I said, oh, by the way, the 2008-2009 market crash was not caused by stock market bubbles. So don't always blame the stock market. And you'll hear people say, stocks are more expensive than they were in 2007 and 8. Well, it wasn't the expense of the, it wasn't the fact that stocks were that expensive in 2008 and 2009. It was the bond market that crushed us. So here are the 11 worst days of the Dow Jones Industrial Average since 1896. And do you notice an interesting pattern? Do you notice anything unusual about that? Anything? Yeah, October. Six of them are in October. One is in early November. And by the way, 2008 makes it on the list. And you'll say, it was the biggest point reduction in history. But on a percentage basis, it wasn't that big, right? It wasn't that big. Why October? Why November? Why do you think? You don't have to be right. No one knows the real answer. There are various reasons that they give, and all of them are wrong. The one answer I think is correct, doesn't mean I'm right, it doesn't mean there's no way to prove it, is that we're not rational. We are animals still. We are humans. And so what happens at the end of the year? In the northern hemisphere, gesundheit, in the north, Winter, yeah, the fall. It's really called the fall for a reason. The plants die off. The sun starts disappearing, right? Sun starts going down. The days get longer. And 1,000 years ago, 10,000 years ago, everybody looked at each other and said, oh, well, you know, a few of us aren't going to make it through the winter. And that's why All Hallows Eve, Halloween, Day of the Dead is in October, November. Because we commemorate the people who have gone before us and realize that, you know, we'll follow them soon enough. I hate it when people, especially, I won't say who, but they say, oh, those Mexicans, they worship the dead. I think, no, I don't understand. That's not what the Day of the Dead is about. It's about remembering them and commemorating them. And forget it. I can't explain people who don't want to be listen. So that's my story I'm sticking with. It doesn't mean I'm right. That's when the mass psychosis takes effect. And people just say, sell, 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 sell. And then it comes back. At the beginning, I mean, in December, it's the new year. The sun starts to come back and people start feeling better. And it turns out the market does better from December to about April. So, sorry.
To be tied to like retail in the form of liquidity.
You know, that's what other people say. It's tax selling. But usually tax selling happens in December. You know, yeah, some people say it's tax selling. I forget there's a few other reasons. But no, there's no way to prove any of these. But that's my story. Okay, now, do you remember this slide? From chapter 4? The proponents of the efficient market theories are going to say you should only, don't bother picking your own stocks. Just don't do it. You're not going to do a good job. You're going to be a horrible. Don't go mutual funds that are actively managed. Go with index funds. Instead of trying to beat the market, just buy the market and be happy with the market's return. The problem with this is that the indexes themselves can become, I use the word skewed, or bent out of shape. For example, now you didn't understand this because we hadn't gone over PE yet. Or maybe you did. But you remember the MSCI EFA? It's being replaced by the All Country World ex-USA. But in the 1980s, most of you weren't around, but I was, and that's when Japan was going to take over the world. There was even a song, I'm Turning Japanese. And the Japanese stock market just skyrocketed. It went to the moon. It hit, you know, it went from like 5,000 to 36,000, something like that, 39,000. And at the time, the EFA was everybody outside the United States, Canada, Western Europe, Hong Kong, Australia, Japan, Singapore, so the developed world outside the United States. So you bought the EFA thinking you're, okay, you're getting, you know, everybody outside the United States, abroad, representation of the companies outside the United States. But fully 60% of the index was Japan with a PE of 52. And everybody else, Canada, Western Europe, I think South Africa was involved in that time, Australia, Hong Kong, was 40% with a much more respectable PE of 13. What happened? In the bubble burst in 1990 and the stock market, the Japanese stock market went from 39,000 down to 8,000. It's never recovered, by the way. It's nowhere near where it was. And the same thing happened at the end of the 1990s. Blue skies, technology, Y2K, internet, productivity gains. The S&P 500 index, fully one-third of it was internet, computers, software, other, they call them, I forget what they call them, but some companies you don't remember, CMGI, the new economy. PE? Is that high? Yeah, but one-third. So everything else, housing, energy, healthcare, consumers, cars, everything else in the S&P 500 was two-thirds of the, still pretty high, 19, not that high, but still high. You see what's going on here? So what happened? The S&P 500, March of 2000, was the peak. It then dropped almost 50% over the next 2.5 years. But the NASDAQ, which was information technology, dropped 80%. So you think you're getting a broadly based diversification of stocks, but you're pushed into these areas that you might not know of. Who did the bonus assignment for Chapter 4? The S&P 500 boogeyman? Nobody in here did that? Several students. I know some of you did it. Several students. Let's look at it because I want you to do it. Okay. No, I'll show you. I'll spoil it for you. If you go, nobody did it. 2 points. That's why I should have made it 5 points. But several of the students in the online class did it. Where is it? Where's the bonus assignment? Here it is. Bonus assignment for Chapter 4. Okay. 4 out of the 5 largest mutual funds in the world are now index funds. Indexing has become the, you can't lose. Low-cost indexing. Don't try to beat the market. So what I ask you to do in this case is take a look at the top 10 companies. The top 10 companies. Who are they? And it's actually very easy to find out. I said, I was hoping you'd do the research, or they would do the research, but you go to standardandpoors.com, you go to their website, and they'll tell you. Or you can go directly to Vanguard 500 or Index Fidelity, or the Index 500, and you'll find the top 10 are companies you'd expect: Apple, Google, Alphabet, Microsoft. I forget who else. I mean, I don't forget. They're there. Did you do it, Laura?
I did.
I think you did. I can look it up. They make up 20%. 10 companies make up 20% of the S&P 500. Now, these are 500 companies, right? And 10 of them make up one-fifth of the index. Yes?
Do weighted indexes balance it out so, like, each company only makes a certain percentage?
That's right. That's why it's called a weighted index. Whereas the Dow Jones Industrial Average is not weighted. It's one of the few that's not weighted. That's an average. This is an index. And I told you about that in Chapter 4, but you forgot about it. That's okay. Everybody else does. So the top 10 make up 20%. The top 50 make up 50%. So you think, I'm getting 500 companies, right? You're getting 10. You're getting 50. They really should call it the S&P 50, right? And by the way, the top companies are the companies that have done the best. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. People think, oh, the S&P 500 is the best way to invest. I'll put money in the S&P 500. What does that do? The managers then have to turn around and buy the stocks. And they have to buy them in the percentages, as Carlos said, which increases the value of those companies, which now are worth more, and more people throw money into the S&P 500 index, so now the managers have to buy more. You see what's happening? They're buying high, and then higher and higher. The managers can't say, look, this is not a good deal. I don't care how great a company Netflix is. I ain't never paying 134 PE. But they have no choice. They can't change their minds. And the same thing happens on the way down. Because as the price goes down, they become worth less in the index. And so what does the manager have to do? They have to sell. You see what's going on? It's a mechanized way of doing business. Now, the people say, don't worry about that. Don't worry about it. It'll all even itself out. Wrong? As we saw, it doesn't. Yeah, it evens itself out when it crashes. So if you want to, you can still do it. I gave you the answers. But do the research, and I think it's a pretty darn good little exercise. I should have made it worth more. So just so you know, it doesn't mean you shouldn't invest in index funds, folks, but just understand, nothing perfect. Nothing perfect. Today in the financial media, index funds and ETFs are touted as the better alternative to actively managed mutual funds. They do have the advantage of very low-cost investing, unless your third-party administrator sneaks a high-cost index fund into your 401k. But decades ago, Mr. Benjamin Graham in The Intelligent Investor warned against any investment strategy that relied on deterministic or robotic decision-making and removed the element of human judgment. The manager can't say, look, this company has gotten beaten down. It's time to buy. No, I got to sell more. This company is way too expensive. No, I got to buy more. I have no choice. And this guy, he's one of my fans, right? some of your fans might be musicians or sports heroes. This is my fan. This guy's sharp. And he could, I told him, I met him. I said, you could have a career in opera. You have a phenomenal voice. And he said, thank you very much. He's a deep, very deep, tall UK, guy from the UK, tall with a deep, profundo, basso profundo. I'm a tenor. I'm not a tenor. I wish I always wanted to be a bass. As with any human endeavor, whether it is athletic competition, the performing arts, or technological innovation, some people clearly perform at a higher than average level. And this guy's one of them, right? He's done better than the market over decades. So, now, let's talk about some silly. So that was some silliness. Here's a lot. Any questions? Am I going too fast? Here's more silliness. You are going to read, hear about some of these things, and they're all balderdash. They're just all ridiculous. Don't pay any attention to them. The Monday effect. Monday is supposed to be the best day to buy, or is it the best day to sell? I can't remember. As goes January, so goes the year. If January does well, then the rest of the year is going to do well. Well, you could say the same thing about any of the months. Oh, as March goes well, then the rest of the year is going to go well. Because the market tends to go up more than it goes down. So for some reason we look at January because it's the beginning of the year. The Santa Claus rally. If the stock market does well in January, it's, oh, it's Santa Claus. But if it does poorly, oh, it's tax selling. Sell in May and go away. Now, there's a kernel of truth to this. Because the best months of the year tend to be from November, December into April, May. The worst months of the year tend to be from the summer into October, November. But over, I mean, there are some glaring examples, which we saw a few slides ago. But over the decades, it's like a 0.5%, 1% difference. If you're going to make any decisions based on that, buying and selling, I don't think so. And then have you heard the Super Bowl theory? Have you heard it? They didn't trot it out this year, I guess because the AFC won. But when the NFC wins, they always say, "Ah, it's a great day, great year for the market." What has happened over the last, you know, several decades, when the National League wins, or a company that used to be in the National League, the stock market has a tendency to go up. When the American League wins, the stock market has a tendency to go down. And the weird thing is, it's been pretty close. It's been actually pretty close to reality. And you say, "Ah, oh, there must be something going on with football." No, it has nothing to do with it. Have you heard of coincidence? In fact, there are all these examples on my website. I don't want to trot them out now. But they look at the incidence of PhDs in chemistry and cheese production in Wisconsin. And it matches perfectly. So obviously, that means this. No. Hemlines. In the 1920s, when hemlines and skirts went up, the stock market went up. In the 1930s, hemlines went down, the stock market went down. See? I mean, you can't make this stuff up, folks. And then there are other, the lipstick indicator, the Boston snow indicator, the BS indicator, the hot waitress indicator, and the aspirin count.
The hot waitress.
I mean, look, you don't believe me. Look it up. There are people actually spilling. I don't remember. Look it up. I don't remember. I know the aspirin count. When they sell more aspirin, that means the market's gone down.
So there's more hot waitresses?
I don't remember it. Look it up. I don't remember it. Look, you guys, you got your cell phones, you got your computers. Look it up. I'm not making this stuff up, right?
But I mean, there's no way to quantify that. Like the others, okay, I can see like how much snow is bought,
right, yeah.
How much lipstick is sold from whatever cause, like, right. You know, how much aspirin. But there's no way to quantify a hot.
You got you, you got internet. You got Wi-Fi
there's
here.
There's no way to quantify that.
I would imagine really hot waitresses indicate great times.
I can hope so. Yes.
Definitely indicate better tips, yeah.
Better tips, right, they get better tips.
The higher the number of good-looking servers, the weaker the current state of the economy.
No. Really? So what does it say? Say it again, Lara. The higher the number of good-looking servers,
the weaker the current state of the economy.
Because they're not getting jobs on Hollywood or something like that? And then what about politics, right? Poly means many and ticks are blood-sucking insects. Which party is better for the market? Which one do you think?
Politics? Bull markets, I'm guessing. The market's going to
market's doing well, they can claim all the credit for it.
Exactly. Yeah. The Republicans are very good at propaganda, at getting their message out. They will make you believe that they're better for the markets. The truth is they're not. And it's not because both parties are dedicated to free market enterprise. Now, you hear all this crap on the left about socialism and all that stuff, and you know, I think it's a lot of it's just posturing because we're not going to nationalize the oil companies. We're not going to nationalize higher education. It's not going to happen, folks. It's just not going to happen. But I think it's just a lot of seeing what they can do to needle. The truth is both parties are dedicated to free market economics. They argue over how much regulation, and there's some, you know, there's a special place in hell for people who over-regulate. There's a special place in hell for people who under-regulate, and they're right next to one another, so they get to scream at each other for eternity. But the truth is that Democratic administrations have been better than the stock, have been better for the stock market than Republican. And again, it has nothing to do, or maybe very little to do, with the actual party. It has to do with just dumb luck. The Great Depression happened during a Republican administration. And then a Democratic administration comes in just at the bottom when it starts coming back. You with me? In 72, 73, that was Nixon, Republican. And then it starts coming back during a Democratic administration. In 2001 and then 2008 was during George Bush the Younger. But again, it had nothing to do with George Bush. Well, the first one. The second one, you could say blame some of the you could blame a lot on the regulation. But the first one, he came in with a high stock market, a bull market that had raged for 20 years. So, you know, he gets the blame when it goes down, even though it has nothing to do with it. So remember, even with all the BS going on now. Okay, so now let's take a look at some all-stars in investing. As we said, I like to look at people who have done a good job. Who do you want to emulate? Who do you want to be like? And there are just dozens and dozens. And I showed you that one book that's on the bibliography called Wall Street People. But here are some folks who are certainly my heroes. Peter Lynch. Who's reading the book? Anybody? What do you think? Isn't he cool? He's not a demagogue. He doesn't think he's perfect. He makes fun of himself. And he says, look, buy what you know. What do you buy? What do you buy? Do you buy Nike shoes? Maybe that's a good company, right? Maybe it's not, you know. You see people in the malls. That was his favorite place to go, was to go with his teenagers to the mall and watch where all the young folks were flocking. And he'd say, okay. And one of his best companies was Dunkin' Donuts. You know? And then he tells you about the companies didn't do well. Warren Buffett says, look, don't buy the stock. Don't think of the stock like as a stock. Think of it like a company. If you could buy the whole company, if you could buy Nike, if you had enough cash to buy Nike, would you do it? Great, buy 10 shares. And then you're eventually, don't read it first, but you're going to want to eventually read The Intelligent Investor, Security Analysis. You've already learned some of the techniques in Security Analysis. You'll learn more. It's tough reading. But the cool thing is that all the newer editions have commentary by Jason Zweig, and that's a very good thing. So after you've read One Up on Wall Street, A Random Walk Down Wall Street, then take on that book. And then Sir John Templeton, one of the first mutual fund managers to invest global. He wasn't the only one, but this is a cool thing from a guy from Tennessee. He became a knight, Sir John Templeton. So, and then Mr. Bill Miller. How are we doing for time? Not bad, not bad. He was the mutual fund manager of the Legg Mason Value Trust. Remember back in Chapter 4? The one that had beaten the S&P 500 for 15 years in a row and then stunk up the place? He became, unfortunately for him, as far as I'm concerned, the financial media's megastar. How would you like to be a celebrity? Would you like that? Maybe your celebrities, you emulate the Kim Kardashians of the world and the Lady Goo-Goos or... what's her name? Lady
Gaga.
Gaga, Lady Gaga. And, well, this was, you know, he was one of the financial media's megastar. How would you like trying to do your job with this 10,000-watt spotlight? Every word you say is hinged on. Well, what happened is he started to stink up the place in 2006, and then 7 and 8 he got hammered. And before that, people, when I showed this, I said, well, they say, do you invest with him? I said, no, I don't. Why? Because he's too concentrated. A mutual fund typically has 100, 200 stocks. He would have 40 or 45. And that worked well when he chose good stocks. When he chose stocks that were, and he was very growth oriented. He loved Amazon. He held on to Amazon for a long time. He seemed to redeem himself, but then trailed badly, and they let him retire in 2012. They didn't fire him. They didn't want to make it look like he was being fired. But now he's somewhere else. He's starting something else. Okay, what do all these people have in common? They have courage, conviction. Because the conventional wisdom is usually not very wise. You'll hear people say the same things over again. Index funds are the only way to invest. And you know what? They don't really understand the downside. They think it's going to always work. No strategy always works. And they have an eye for unrecognized value. I like to call it a sixth sense. They see something else that others don't see. Everybody's concentrating in this, and they say, no, you don't understand. Look at this. That's a reason to buy. That's a reason to sell. And then, have you ever heard of these two gentlemen? This was a long time ago. Garry Kasparov and Anatoly Karpov. Throughout the late 80s and into the 90s, they were the two reigning world chess champions. One would win one year, and another one would win the other year. They were beating each other up. They were the two best chess champions. And while they were, eventually Mr. Kasparov became the reigning champion, and then he was beaten by a computer. Look it up, it's cute. He was beaten by the IBM's Deep Thought, now is what they call Watson. He was asked once why he and Anatoly Karpov were the two best chess players in the world. His answer was astonishingly simple and direct. We attack better than anybody else, and we defend better than anybody else. You see? Can you hit a fastball at 98 miles an hour? Can you throw a fastball at 98 miles an hour? Right? You'll never know until you try. Don't try it. But that's the same idea. The cool thing is you don't have to be the best in the world. You don't have to be the world champion to be a good investor. So you don't have to think that you have to be like him. These people in this world, they bought the best companies and they avoided the worst companies. Speaking of avoidance, as a mutual fund investor, which I primarily am, I am not looking to find the next Peter Lynch or Bill Miller or Warren Buffett. I am looking to avoid the next Charles Stedman. You ever hear of Charles Stedman? There's a very good reason why you've never heard of him. He was a total failure. But he was incredibly persistent. Now, I want you to be persistent. You know, I always tell my online students, don't give up, never give up. But when you're really, really bad at something, it's time to find something else to be. He ran his own mutual fund, the Stedman American Industry Fund, which is a bad, name it after yourself, not a good idea, right? From December 1959 until his death in late 1997, when he mercifully died, right? His cumulative total return over that time, during one of the largest expansions of the global economy in the world, was -43%. I mean, think about how, if he just put the money into a savings account, he would have done better, right? Or put it under his mattress. Oh, maybe he came from the life insurance industry. So you see what? This is what you're trying to avoid. You don't have to find the best person. You don't have to find the best. Just find something that ain't going to do what Mr. Stedman does. Okay, and now here's some sayings. There's some great sayings that hopefully you'll internalize. And this one's very popular now. This is Warren Buffett. You'll see this in the media all the time. Warren Buffett says, be fearful when others are greedy. Be greedy when others are fearful. When everybody's running that way? Right. Now, he's really just paraphrasing what his boss, what his teacher said. He said it this way, but it's, I think this is better said here. But buy when most people, including experts, are overly pessimistic, and sell when they are actively optimistic. It's the same thing, right? He wants to grab that one. That's a very famous quote. And then another one. Now here's John Templeton. Bear markets are born of pessimism, grow on skepticism, mature on optimism, and die on euphoria. The time of maximum pessimism is the best time to buy. On a similar note, he also said, to buy when others are despondently selling and sell when others are avidly buying requires the greatest fortitude and pays the greatest reward. Now, did Sir John Templeton follow his own advice? Yes, he did. December 1941. You history buffs, what happened in December 1941? Right, well, it was already going on. But for the United States, yes. For the United States, we finally got sucked into the war. Efron here? No. And Joshua Smith is here, right? Where is he? He was here. And, okay. I thought I had somebody here. I guess I don't. He calls up his broker. The Third Fleet has been almost destroyed, right? The Pacific Third Fleet. We get sucked into the war. Europe is already completely taken over, except for the
Britain.
They're the only people left. Russia is falling. Russia's falling. It hadn't fallen yet. And it stiffened in 42, and then 43 came back. And we're now looking really bad because we just lost our fleet in one attack. And this yo boy calls up his broker and says, I want you to buy every bankrupt company on the New York Stock Exchange. You see that? Would you have that kind of courage? I want you to buy every bankrupt company, not just any company, bankrupt companies. 4 years later, the war is over, and Mr. Templeton is a very wealthy man. Famous myths and stupid sayings. Okay, just a few more slides. It can't go any lower. You'll hear people say this. When can it not go any lower? When it's zero. Right, that it can't. Once it's zero, it can't go any lower. It can't go any higher. You hear people say this? Oh, yes, it can. If the earnings are continuing to grow, there's no limit to how high the price can go. So that's why I'm not buying Netflix. But I don't want to be nasty to people who say buying it and say, you're stupid. Because they might not be stupid. Because what's going to happen with Netflix? Disney's now moving in, right? Who else wants to move into their space? What? Apple wants to move in. Who else? Somebody else wants to move in. I forget. One of the other big people. I forget. Okay. It's only $3 a share. What can I lose?
$3,
right? It has to come back. Do you ever hear Penn Central or Pan Am or Kodak? You know, sometimes they don't come back. It's always darkest before the dawn. Well, sometimes it's always darkest before it's pitch black. When it rebounds, you hear people say this, when it rebounds to $7 or $20 or whatever. Why? We're going to see this in Chapter 8 on Tuesday. People don't want to admit they made a mistake. They bought it at $10. When it goes back to $10, they'll sell it so they can say, I got out without a loss. If it ain't working for you, and some of them won't, if you wouldn't buy it now, it's at $6 or $3, you wouldn't buy it right now at whatever price it is, it's time to sell and find something else. We have to admit we make mistakes. You're going to make mistakes. You're going to make mistakes, and you're not going to be as bad as Mr. Charles Stedman. I don't think so, as long as you keep your eyes open. If it goes down 10%, sell. Now, this is what you'll see on Tuesday, when people set these stops, if it goes down this much, I'll sell. The problem is, stock prices fluctuate greatly, as we saw. Even blue chips. If you sold each one that lost 10%, you're just going to sell everything eventually. You're almost always going to sell your winners. Now, I understand what they're trying to say. We don't want you to lose a lot. But you're going to consistently lose, because every time it goes down, you're going to sell. So I don't think it's a good idea. People will get impatient, and they'll want to go with the marijuana stocks. It takes a long time. Investing in stocks, in my humble opinion, if you do it the way we talk about here, it does take time. It doesn't happen overnight. Now, maybe you'll get lucky and hit on the next small-cap company that becomes a large-cap company. It never worked for me. Look at all the money I lost. I didn't buy it. You didn't buy it. You didn't lose any money, right? Could have, would have, should have. You don't lose a cent by not buying a stock that did well. I missed that one. I'll catch the next one. Does that happen? Not too often. I'll buy the next Microsoft. Well, yeah, there's going to be another industry where there's going to be a Microsoft. There's going to be another industry where there's another Google. But there's not going to be another Microsoft, right? In the software industry, it's just not going to happen. So buy that company if you believe that. Now, sometimes it does. Home Depot? They exploded and became, you know, the do-it-yourself, put out all the, used to be mom-and-pop hardware stores. Who came along?
Lowe's.
Yeah. So Lowe's, there was another Home Depot, Lowe's, and now the two of them are sort of saturated. Home Depot, I think, is doing better, though. They're going internationally. They're going globally. The stock has gone up. I must be a genius. The stock's gone down. I must be an idiot. One of my favorite mutual, he's retired now, but he started in 1962. Which was the beginning of a really strong bull market, 62 to like 70, 72. And he said, that was a really bad deal for me. because I started to think I was invincible. Everything we bought went up. I thought, oh, what a genius I am. Oh. It's better to start, you know, when you get your knuckles bloody. The stock's gone down. I must be an idiot. Not necessarily. It just means you made a mistake and you're going to make mistakes. Reevaluate it. Would you buy it? You know, it's now 60% of what you paid $10 at $60. Would you buy it now at $6? Yeah. Okay, buy more. Don't be cruel to yourself. It's different this time. It's a new era. It's a permanent trend. Oh, permanent trend? No, it's an oxymoron, like jumbo shrimp. Military intelligence, right? Straight curve. And you're going to hear people say this too. And you have to acknowledge that, because some people are going to be, but stocks are too risky. Stocks are too risky. You have to say, you know, they are risky, but we have techniques that can help mitigate the risk. And if you look at the long term, they've still been the best long-term financial investment. So you have to, you know, you have to tell the truth. Cool? Any questions on these? Because that's chapter 7. Now, when we get to chapter 8, Slycology, we'll see even more silliness. And then, I'm sorry. Psychology. And then we will go over at least one constant perpetual growth model and discounted cash flow model. Remember, the exam is next Thursday. So study again, chapters 5 and 6, and then review the material 17 and 7. And turn in those assignments. What you waiting for? Who's got the worksheet? I'm at the grade sheet. Anybody got the grade sheet? Anybody have the grade sheet? So who put it in the back of their notebook? Who's got the grade sheet?
I don't remember.
Oh, I did. I handed it out. Somebody put it in their notebook and then left. Okay. What? Not every. Didn't happen on Tuesday, but it happened today. Okay, I'll print out another one next week.